Hey everyone, I'm Nick Gurich. I'm the director of the EPRMA department. I just threw everyone on mute all so that we can get started with our lunch live chat. You have the ability to unmute yourself, but we're getting a lot of attendees right now. So I want to make sure that we're able to manage everybody in the group, and we have a couple special guests that we're going to definitely want to hear from, and we only have about 45 minutes. So I think we're going to ask that if people have questions for the guests, that you put them in the chat. We may not be able to get to all of them, but then we'll have a record of them and we can follow up even if we're not able to address them on the call. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Scott Tamora, OEA President.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. It is good to see you. Thanks for joining us today. And glad that you're participating in our OEA Summer Leadership Academy in a very different kind of setting than we're used to. I'm going to introduce our two special speakers, special guests in just a moment. Before I get to that, though, I just a few things that I wanted to share from my perspective as we have this conversation this afternoon about are thinking about going back to school, whatever that's going to look like, however that's going to happen, whenever that's going to happen. First off, I know that there is a lot of stress. There's a lot of anxiety because there is so much uncertainty, and we're all still waiting for the governor to make an announcement and for official guidance to be coming. We expect that there is going to be an announcement sometime soon. I will ask you not to ask when that's coming, because we don't know. Unless there's new information from Paulo since the last time I talked to him just a few hours ago, I just don't expect that we're going to be able to answer that question. But I do want to talk a little bit about the process that we have been engaging in. And I want to acknowledge particularly the leadership of our state superintendent for being extremely collaborative. OEA has been a partner in joining conversations on the whole idea of restarting school and having a reset, and really making sure that we've got educator voices at the table as those conversations are happening. We know that if we're going to be successful, we have to work together. We have to work with our superintendents and our school boards. We have to work with our education support professionals and teachers and other people who work in schools. We have to work in community with our parents and with our students. And very, very importantly, and this is why I'm really, really pleased that Dr. Francis from the Department of Health is with us, we have to work very closely in collaboration with public health officials. I don't have expertise as a public health expert in any way. I'm not going to substitute my judgment for that. All of us read the news. All of us, see what's happening. But we very, very much depend on the expertise of people who have made a career out of public service around the health needs of our communities, the health needs of our students, the health needs of the adults who work in our schools, to help guide some important decision making. I want to say that as OEA has been advocating from the very beginning, first off, I am so amazed by the incredible work that our members were able to do, turning on a dime. It was just a matter of a few days between when the governor made the announcement that schools were going to be closing for what we originally thought was an extended spring break, what ended up being, a remote learning situation through the end of the year, to adapt to new strategies and really focusing on meeting basic needs of students and doing incredible heroic work to make sure that we were supporting students and supporting one another. As we've been advocating through this whole experience, our number one priority is making sure that we protect the health and safety of our members, of everybody who works in schools, of our communities, and very importantly, of our students. And sometimes that gets lost in the conversation. We support flexibility. We don't believe that it's the state's role to decide all the details of what's going to happen when schools are reopening. However, there needs to be very clear parameters from our perspective on what is safe. And then we act accordingly from there. We have been advocating for making sure that we're taking time, that there's a real deliberate effort to make sure that we're learning from the successes and failures of the last 3 months in planning for this coming school year. And that means, again, that educators have to be at the table in every single local school district around the state as decisions for what the 2020-2021 school year are going to look like. We also know that this pandemic has exposed and exacerbated really, really deep inequities in our system. We know that communities of color are disproportionately affected from a public health standpoint by the coronavirus, and our health system, you know, needs to adjust. In the same way, we know it, and we all have experienced it for many, many years, that our education system needs to do a lot more to make sure that where a student comes from or who their family is or what they look like doesn't determine, you know, their success. And we know that, you know, issues ranging from technology access to meals and you know, just core needs and family support, you know, those kinds of disparities that exist across districts and within districts are things that we really have to be mindful in addressing as we plan moving forward. And then the last thing is, we know that there are more needs given these uncertainties than we've ever seen before. And so we need resources. And that's why we're continuing to advocate for state and local dollars to be prioritized for education, but especially for federal resources to also be prioritized for education. So that's some context. As far as our process today, as Nick said, after I introduce and give each of our speakers a chance to make a few opening comments, I'll ask you to put any questions that you would like to ask in the chat box. And we want to try to get to as many questions as we can. And then about 12:40, I'll ask our speakers if they want to make any closing comments, if there are things that they wanted to address that they didn't get a chance to do through the Q&A. So two special guests. First one, many of you are already familiar with, State Superintendent Paulo Di Maria. If you know Paulo like I do, you know that he is a passionate leader, a tireless worker, a respectful listener, and an energetic advocate for Ohio's 1.7 million students. All of those are qualities he has called on daily during his 3 years as Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction. And I have had the good fortune, especially in the last year since I've been president, to develop a good, close working relationship with Paulo. His proudest accomplishment is the Ohio Department of Education's partnership with stakeholders to develop the Each Child, Our Future Ohio Strategic Plan for Education. He devotes his energy to realizing Ohio's vision that each child is challenged to discover and learn, prepared to pursue a fulfilling post-high school path, and empowered to become a resilient lifelong learner who contributes to society. Mr. Di Maria believes that everyone shares the responsibility of preparing children for successful futures. With educators, partners, community organizations, and parents working together, Ohio's 3,600 schools and thousands of teachers can create bright futures for our students in our state. Mr. Di Maria has served Ohio citizens for 28 years as an organizational leader, policy expert, and education champion. His key roles have included Chief Policy Advisor to Governor Bob Taft, Director of the Office of Budget and Management for the State of Ohio, and Executive Vice Chancellor of the Ohio Department of Higher Education. I'll ask Paulo to speak in just a moment, but please give an OEA welcome to Paulo Di Maria. I also want to welcome Dr. Mary Kate Francis. She is the Acting Medical Director with the Ohio Department of Health. She has experience, she's been working with ODH as Assistant Medical Director for the last 3.5 years. Before that, she was in emergency medicine at Ohio Health and at Cleveland Clinic, Akron General, which is connected to the Cleveland Clinic. She, like myself, is a graduate of Miami University, and it looks like we were attending Miami at about the same time, which is pretty cool. So really happy that Dr. Mary Kate Francis is with us today as well. And I'm going to ask Mary Kate, Dr. Francis, if you wouldn't mind starting and just give us some context in terms of what do we need to know about the state of coronavirus in Ohio right now, as we just to kind of provide some context for this conversation about reopening of schools.
Certainly. Thank you, Scott. I'm very glad to be here. And can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, good. As Scott said, I am the interim medical director at the Ohio Department of Health currently. I am happy to be in that position and have been with the department for a few years now as assistant medical director, and took on the role of interim when Dr. Mark Hurst retired recently. Obviously the attention to school and the transition into reopening schools is very, very important to the Ohio Department of Health. Given that we have a pandemic that hopefully in our lifetimes we will not see again, we have to be very, very thoughtful about how we move forward with this reopening. And as was stated initially, I believe that we don't have that all those guidelines set in stone yet. Many are on this conference and panel are aware that this is a novel pathogen. So this is something that daily we're learning about and finding more and more. And so as we move along, we want to ensure that we're garnering the best information and applying that to our guidance for schools. So we have a large group of people that are addressing that guidance, experts in the field, and ensuring that the safety of everyone involved in the school environment, obviously students, staff, ancillary support staff, are all going to be protected when we do return to school. Additionally, we want to make sure that those transitions from school to home are something that take place very easily and safely, because people may be in situations where they have at-risk populations at home also. So we always have to have that consideration. But we do know that people are very excited to get back to kind of our new normal, which I don't know that we're ever going to have a complete normal, as we see just simply from this virtual arena we're in today. But I think I'm hopeful that our new normal will find that we are all comfortable in that space as we move forward, and we'll all get a little more used to the measures that we're planning to put in place. And obviously those basic measures, which I'm sure we've all become very familiar with, our distancing, masking, ensuring that sanitizing is happening, hand hygiene, and I apologize for all the noises in the background with the beeping, and obviously then staying home when ill. That's what we want to make sure, that there's an attempt that we are a little more flexible when we do move back into that space to allow, children and the adults that are involved to have that flexibility, that they can even still participate if need be, if they may have had an exposure and they could still participate in an environment such as this, or the staff themselves can also be off and not have to worry about the risking their job or any sort of repercussions, because that's the safest environment, is to keep those that may have been exposed potentially ill out of that environment, so we can keep that space as safe as possible.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that overview, and I'm sure we're going to have some questions to dig a little deeper into a couple of the things that you just mentioned. Superintendent DeMaria, if you could tell us a little bit about, provide a little more context in terms of how you and the Department of Education and our education stakeholders have been thinking about, this whole concept of going back to school. And in addition to the health issues that Dr. Francis talked about, what are some of the other key principles and key considerations that drive your thinking?
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott. And thanks to all of you for having me with you today. I always start a conversation like this just with a tremendous demonstration of gratitude and thanks. Thanks to all of you for everything that you've done during the period that school buildings were closed in the interest of helping support the continuity of education for our students and, you know, providing them care and support, educational services, and what have you. And also just generally for being teachers, choosing to embrace and be practitioners with that motivation that I know all teachers have of really being committed to the success of our students and providing them with care and love and support and opportunities to learn and grow and become the citizens that we want them to be for the future of our state and our communities and our nation. To Scott's point, you know, we are now pivoting into the next, you know, phase of this experience, this really unknown experience. It's almost like, you know, being blindfolded in a corn maze or in some kind of haunted house where you don't know what's going to happen around the next corner. You know, on the one hand, we keep learning new things, which is useful. But on the other hand, we still understand, you know, that there's a lot of unknowns out there. And so, you know, first and foremost, our posture has been to be very much in collaboration with the Department of Health. We've been very closely in conversation with their health experts. Our job, we think, has been to help them understand, you know, what all is involved in operating schools and buses and kitchens and cafeterias and so forth and so on, so they can have a good sense of the context of the education, you know, the business of educating students and what actually it looks like. Because they need to, and you've seen the governor do this with many of the sectors, bring practitioners together with health professionals to sort of sort through, you know, pros and cons of different approaches, understanding the realities of what happens and maybe what has to happen in order to function effectively. And try to find the one that makes the most sense. So, partners that oversee safety, you know, and Scott, all the great going on early, and we had clear. I don't know if I'm having connectivity problems.
I think maybe your internet is a little unstable right now and your audio is coming in and out. Hopefully it'll kind of catch up. So keep going for a minute.
Maybe I'll turn off my video and that might help from this end.
Okay.
I don't know if that's,
that sounds a whole lot better.
Okay, great. So partnership, working to understand the realities that people face. And so when, and many of you have seen, we sort of put out a draft document maybe almost 2 months ago that had some of our initial thinkings. And I think the first thing we're cognizant of is that when students come back to school, our first order of business really to understand where are they in terms of their knowledge acquisition and their readiness. Right. And I've tried to avoid using in my vocabulary terms like, you know, falling behind or catching up, you know, because I think sometimes those words impose onto the students some sort of responsibility. And when they hear those terms, I think they take it personally that maybe it's something they did. And they actually didn't do anything. Their learning was interrupted. And we just need to better understand where they are so that we can pick up from that point and go forward. So that notion of needs assessment and figuring out where students are so that we can know, and that can then inform what the educational experience looks like going forward, I think that's going to be important. I think then you're going to see a lot of people thinking about, you know, what does the educational experience look like, especially if we assume that there's going to be more variability across all those different students. So I think you're going to see some people talking more in terms of how do we personalize the learning experience. How do we help each student, you know, sort of start where they are, but then continue to progress at, you know, the rate that is most, you know, amenable to where they are, and helping them move forward. And sometimes that may require you know, a greater differentiation of instruction or differentiation in the academic experience, so that the students that are, you know, that are struggling more in terms of the content that they're facing are getting the help they need, and others are allowed to go, you know, at the pace that suits them. So I think you're going to see a lot of discussions. In fact, you know, I've heard Eric Gordon up in Cleveland talking about sort of more competency-based approaches or mastery-based approaches. You know, I think that actually made a lot of sense even before the pandemic, but I think it makes even more sense now. Because I think going back to Scott's comments about, you know, inequities, I think some of the inequities of the past were that we weren't always thorough in making sure students mastered the subject area and acquired the knowledge they needed to succeed at that, you know, before they went into the next level of learning. And consequently, they found themselves, you know, not being able to perform as well as expected. And then the system wasn't always able to rectify those situations. So can we be tuned into that a little bit more effectively at this point in the process and continue to move forward? So that's going to take, you know, some creativity, some innovation. One of the things I loved during the closure period was I saw so many more teachers sort of talking to each other over social media. We, in fact, tried to facilitate some meetups around different content areas. I saw administrators talking to each other, you know, sharing, you know, their challenges, their successes, things that they were trying that weren't working, bumps in the road that they were encountering. And it was great because I think it really amplified the kinds of communities of practice that we really want to see in Ohio. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. People sharing ideas, engaging, asking questions, trying new things, because I think it's going to be an opportunity to do exactly that. I think we're also going to have to rely a lot on, you know, a couple of attributes that I think we nurtured during the closure period. First and foremost, flexibility. You know, there's still, going back to what Dr. Francis said, is, you know, there could be flare-ups. There could be things that happen, maybe within a single building, maybe across a district, maybe in a community. There might be things that happen statewide where it's going to put us in a position where things have to, you know, change and, again, pivot on a dime. So we're going to have to be ready. And in many schools and districts, they're thinking about, well, what's going to happen if something like that does happen? I think we're also going to have flexibility around different levels of ability to participate in group activities. So students that may have certain health risk factors that make them more susceptible to coronavirus, or frankly, adults in our schools or on our buses or in other settings that may be more susceptible, we're going to have to be very conscious of their desires not to be put into a position where they get exposed, which again means that there's going to have to be flexibility on the part of many participants, and some empathy and some creative approaches to not simply say, look, if you're not able to come to school to teach, that's the end of the line, because it shouldn't be the end of the line. And the same with the family that may not want a student to go to school because of that student's conditions, or maybe at the home there are vulnerable adults. In fact, I just had an email this morning from somebody who kind of explained that particular situation and was, you know, asking that we be really cautious when we reopen because of those kinds of circumstances. Again, that's a situation that requires patience and empathy and creative thinking and innovative approaches, so that we're not necessarily saying to anybody, look, if you can't get your child to school, then, you know, that's a problem. So all this adds complexity. It adds complexity, which, you know, is where patience is going to come in, and it's going to challenge our creative thinking, our problem solving. But we showed a lot of good creative thinking and problem solving during the school building closure. And so I'm confident that we're going to be able to get through this as well. And that our students will once again sort of surprise us at their ability to exceed even our highest expectations for what they can accomplish. And I think, frankly, our own expectations of the education system are going to exceed what we set, because I think time and time again, it's that dedication, commitment, stick-to-itiveness that really shined during the school building closure period, and I know will kind of come out in the school reopening. So I'll stop there, Scott, with, you know, just those sort of brief overview comments, and happy to answer the questions that might surface.
Thanks, appreciate that. And so I'm going to just go to the first question that I see is from NJ Burkett, and your question seems pretty straightforward. So MJ, in the interest of time, I'll just ask it for you. This is directed to Dr. Francis. And I'll just let you know, Dr. Francis, that MJ's from Steubenville in Eastern Ohio. Says that his superintendent wants staff to wear plastic face shields as opposed to cloth masks. Are the shields as effective as masks? And I will just add, I've heard other places that are thinking about using face shields as an alternative to masks, particularly with students and younger students. So can you comment on that?
I'll get the hang of this mute button, I promise, as I go along. Certainly, that's a great question. And thanks for joining us today. Issue that we run into with the face shields is, depending on how the face shields are manufactured or how they're going to sit on the face, we want them to be able to be lower than the chin and extending, you know, around the face rather than just something that comes down like a, I can't even think of what would be a little different from that. But there are some out there that don't provide that extent of protection. There is, there's varied information out there about it, obviously, that does not provide necessarily any sort of barrier protection. Let's say if there's something aerosolized, a student around you sneezes and you happen to be within that period, that environment or that space where that aerosol is going to be, the droplets and aerosols, potentially with a face shield, that's not going to be something that's going to protect you from inhaling those aerosols or provide a layer of barrier. It is a more of a barrier that will provide you protection from any direct droplets or spread or things like that. Let's say the child sneezes directly on your mask, on your face shield, that's a different story. So there is a kind of some varied information out there, and studies are being done right now. So we will have to see where that guidance will lead. And I understand the interest in that, because there are a lot of students that benefit from, you know, the facial expressions and the information that comes from that, rather than simply the verbal information that they can garner. So I do understand that there's an interest in moving forward with that potentially, if we can get that into the guidance. Thank you for that question.
Yeah, thanks. This second question is directed to you, Paulo. Can you talk about busing and social distancing? I've heard superintendents say that that's like a number one concern. What specificity are you expecting that the department's going to put out in terms of guidance on social distancing and transportation?
Yeah, so this is a great question, because in some respects, it is sort of the ultimate limiter on the kind of activity that can take place, because we're not really in a position to sort of double the bus fleet, right? And so to the extent that there are limitations on how many students can be put on a bus, that forms sort of a constraint on the system. So there will be guidance about buses. The real challenge there is, you know, how will they be structured in terms of, you know, either differentiation by virtue of the communities that the buses are serving, or choices that a district may be able to make in terms of, you know, if you're using masks, if you're using distancing, what are the implications? One of the things I've learned in this whole experience is that it's this combination of factors, right? The distance I am from another person, that's a factor, and the farther away I am, the better. If I'm closer and I add a mask, then the mask, you know, helps further reduce risk. If our encounter is short, so the other issue is sort of this duration of account of encounters. If a runner runs by me while we're walking on the sidewalk and he's within 6 feet, that's, you know, very limited risk, because my chance encounter with him is just so short. Whereas if I'm with a person for a long period of time, or even worse, with a group of people with a long period of time, then it's better to be to you know, distance myself and then to wear a mask. So it's all those three things: duration, masking, and distance, that kind of play in with each other. And of course, a bus is by nature a closed place, and in many parts of the state, bus rides can be very, very long. So, you know, that factors into the thinking as well. So, you know, bottom line is, yes, there will be guidance. I know many schools and districts are trying to think of alternatives. You know, are there ways to encourage, you know, and this isn't always a really great response, because buses are also the safest way to transport children. But if there are more opportunities for students to get to school, either by their parents or, you know, in other ways, you know, those can help alleviate some of the challenges to the transportation system. So yes, you'll see some guidance coming out around buses. And again, I think you'll see a lot of creative thinking being applied to how best to manage within those guidelines, the challenge of getting kids to school.
So one of the things that that Lauren Stanislaw's question in the chat box, I think, is a big one in the context of this whole discussion about the push and pull tug of war between state level guidance and local control. I know there's legislation that's been introduced by Senator Huffman. In fact, I'm going to be testifying against that bill tomorrow, that essentially would give decisions about opening schools, you know, completely put it in the hands of school boards and superintendents. But let's assuming, maybe I shouldn't make an assumption, but when we see the state guidance, you know, there is this question about enforcement. And I'm wondering if either of you or both of you can talk about what you anticipate, assuming that there are some non-negotiables that come down from the governor and the Department of Health. Who will be responsible for ensuring that schools are complying with that guidance?
So maybe I'll start a little bit and just share my understanding, and then Dr. Francis maybe can chime in as well. You know, if you look at the other sectors of the economy, the responsibility for enforcement has really fallen to local health departments. And one of the things I've said routinely when I'm meeting with superintendents or in other conference settings or what have you is to every school district, make sure you have a good relationship with your local health department. And you know, the issue of enforcement, though, is a little bit tricky, because on the one hand, the local health department will be a great partner to Scott's point of local control. As a district decides, okay, well, here are the guidelines by the state. There's a lot of discretion, maybe a lot of flexibility. You know, we're going to choose to go down this path, and this is what it's going to look like. You know, the local health department needs to be a voice as, you know, and a partner in those discussions. I think what happens more significantly is if certain things start to happen, a teacher in a school, you know, is diagnosed with COVID, right? What does that trigger? Both in terms of changes in the school, you know, quarantining, you know, additional precautions. Does the school need to close over a couple of days to sanitize before it reopens? Contact tracing and those kinds of things. And making sure that people are duly diligent when there is evidence that something's happened. Because I think the other thing that happens is if there's evidence in a community, we're starting to see now, you know, in other parts of the country, right? All the newspaper headlines are about Florida seeing a surge in South Carolina and Arizona, you know, and even within Ohio, you're starting to see little pockets. You know, generally those flare-ups come from, you know, a church gathering or, you know, a large group gathering that happened. You know, I've heard about like Holmes County is seeing a little bit of a bump up because of tourism and so forth and so on. I think the local health department then becomes a player in saying, because we see this in our community, we really need to up our game in terms of taking extra precautions and imposing extra limitations. Again, where the local control comes in is those paying close attention to those local circumstances and reacting appropriately.
Thanks. Dr. Francis, anything you wanted to add about that and the role of local health departments?
I just think that was an excellent response. I think many people probably are concerned about how this will, if the rules aren't being followed or if they see something that is concerning who they will go to and who they will follow. Obviously, the chain of command in your schools and in your school district will still apply, but we are always there to be responsive, obviously. and your local health department is too, which we partner with. I think if we didn't all learn from our siblings growing up that someone's going to tell on you if you're not following the rules, then we all learned it when we went to school, that someone's going to tell on you if you're not following the rules. So I think if anyone out there is concerned that, you know, that their district or their school may not be putting the things into place that should be, obviously we've found out over these few months with different things opening up, we typically find out, and we do partner with the local health department, and that communication is there. So if it doesn't make it to them and it makes it to us, we get it back to the appropriate people. But we definitely recommend that you look to your local health department. They have not only good ideas about what should be implemented and what to do around those implementations, but also they have remedies for things that you may run into as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. And one thing that I heard in your response, and this is something that we've raised as a suggestion, is that, you know, some of that, it, as you said, is going to depend on circumstances on the ground at a given time. So if there is no virus activity in a particular community, then maybe the stringency of the limitations may be such that there you don't have to be strictly adhering to everything as much as you would if there is some kind of spread at a given time. Is that a safe summary, I guess, of what I heard or what you expect?
Yes, and we actually are looking at with the state. We have a group, another work group, obviously, of experts that are looking into a response system, kind of like what you're alluding to, where if you have an area where your local spread isn't what we're seeing in necessarily central Ohio, and you can loosen restrictions and be a little more flexible with what's going on, then you'll have that opportunity in that area rather than having to be as stringent as everywhere else. So yes, that is something that is on the horizon and hopefully will be beneficial for everyone.
Good. Question about, and I know there's a couple of special ed related questions, which I want to get to next, but this hopefully short answer on this one, singing and playing instruments in music classes and ensembles, what's the talk on that at this point?
Tim, you're after my heart, because I was a singer all through middle and high school and just love music. I have been talking with the people at the OMEA from the outset, both to, like, for us to cry on each other's shoulders because of the implications of this circumstance, but also to kind of encourage ourselves that we'll get through it. You know, singing is a complicated phenomenon, right? Because all the things that I said are violated. You're bringing lots of people together. You know, masks aren't particularly conducive to the vocal quality that you're trying to achieve. And not only that, is like, you're just moving tremendous volumes of air in a very confined space. I cringed at some of those early news stories about, I think it was in Oregon, where, you know, the church choir, you know, they had 82 people come down with coronavirus out of 150 voices or something like that. It was really on the scary and sobering. You know, at the end of the day, I think there are going to be ways to address that, but they're going to, you know, require really sort of out of the box thinking from the ways that we're used to working. In fact, my most recent conversation was about marching bands and marching bands. You know, how do those relate to maybe some of the sports guidelines that are being issued right now? Because, you know, obviously there's a coincidence of interests between marching bands and football players. And as well as others. So we're trying to work through those to be responsible, but also understand that those particular circumstances, you know, in some ways exacerbate the realities, and we want to be very careful.
So I want to talk about the reality that particularly educators, both teachers and paraprofessionals who work with and psychologists and speech pathologists, you know, but people that work in settings in close proximity to students, particularly students with special needs, What has been some of the discussion and thinking around that? And also, because I know this is a really complex issue, we know that through the period of remote learning, there was from the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education, some relaxation of some of the expectations in terms of accommodations and services being provided to students with special needs. But I think that was all with everybody understanding that that was not intended to be long-term. So really kind of combining both the health interests of, you know, the challenge of providing that kind of close contact support, but also making sure that we're not neglecting and amplifying the inequity that exists for students on IEPs. Either one of you can start on that one.
Yeah, so again, I'll start. You know, I think the best advice I can give is to, you know, be committed to helping students, but also be committed to being, you know, a safe practitioner, and putting yourself and making sure that you're working in safe circumstances, right? Because I think a lot of times we make assumptions, you know, okay, I'm gonna be working with the student, you know, and then you wonder, well, did the student, you know, was their temperature taken this morning, or what's their situation at home? Have they been exposed to anybody, or have they been in any large groups? And then what's my circumstance as a teacher? Am I healthy? Am I making sure that I'm, you know, not taking additional risks that might put myself in a position of compromising a student's health? So one of the things is just being deliberate. And sometimes that means we have to ask, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to ask questions right now to make sure the people we're interacting with are, you know, taking the necessary precautions, so we don't necessarily put either a student or an adult at risk in those kind of situations. You know, the other thing is, to the extent that there are opportunities to use, remote, you know, either telehealth options or other remote options, you know, we should take advantage of those. And I know many people have told me, well, this just can't be done remotely. Totally understand that. But to the extent that there are some things that can be done, we should explore those, because as you can imagine, you know, the broader healthcare community is, you know, developing all kinds of practices that they're finding to be useful and effective in dealing with all kinds of circumstances and situations. At the end of the day, though, we still have, you know, the federal laws that we have to comply with and meeting those requirements, but it doesn't mean we can't do our best to minimize the risks that accompany that. You know, and at the same time, every teacher, I think, has to examine their own dispositions around, you know, their own health status and their own levels of comfort and what alternatives there might be. If there are alternatives available to the providing of services, you know, what might that look like, and how do those, how do those become part of the service plan? And again, that's where the creativity and problem solving kind of dispositions come into the mix.
All right, thanks. So we have just a couple minutes left. I want to just quickly address a couple things that are in the chat. And again, for any of the questions that we haven't gotten to, the ones that we can answer ourselves, we'll make sure that we respond to people and provide that information. And we'll forward the questions that we can't answer to Dr. Francis and Mr. DeMaria where appropriate. But don't forget guidelines for secretaries and front office staff. It is absolutely part of the draft guidance that we have been working with ODE and developing. So you know, the latest draft of that addresses those issues very explicitly. Sherry Bean's question about having two people to a seat on a bus. The last draft that I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, does not say that that's okay unless they happen to be from the same household. Otherwise, the 6-foot social distancing is enforced there. So correct me if I'm wrong on either one of those items. And I'll just turn to each of you, starting with Dr. Francis, if you have any parting words for us.
Well, I thank you all for having me today, and I just wanted to let you know that I had had a student here at home with me over these last few months with the distance learning, and I have the utmost respect for teachers, because that's not something I think I could ever do. You guys demonstrated a great deal of resilience and flexibility in navigating the distance learning that came upon you very quickly. We want to move forward, obviously, with empathy, flexibility, and patience, and pay attention to all the issues that you brought up. As you could see, I was taking notes, probably, you could see that during this, so that we can definitely give attention to all the issues, items brought up, and then any others that people have contacted us about. So we are being very thoughtful in this process and look forward to keeping everyone happy and healthy this next school year.
All right, thank you very much. Paula?
Yeah, I love the title of this conference, People, Power, and Opportunities, because I think those are three great words that are very essential to the school reopening process. And I guess, my advice to you is, be a voice in the process. Scott knows, as do the heads of most of the other major associations in the state, that we've really been pushing collaboration. This is not, reopening schools is not something that administrators should put themselves in a room, or the school board should put itself in a room and make decisions and then come out and say, this is how it's going to be. They really need to be collaborative and allow the different voices to be heard. Right now, to be honest with you, some of the loudest voices are the voices that sort of, deny that either there's any longer a coronavirus issue, or maybe that there never was one. They point to the very low rates of incidence of the disease from children. And I constantly have to remind them that, yes, while it is about the safety of children, it's actually more about the safety of adults. And because adults are the ones that are interacting with those children, both in the school and then back at home, and the students are the ones that are carriers. And so those voices are really loud to go back to school 5 days a week, every day, no restriction on buses, no mask wearing, and so forth and so on. And there needs to be that countervailing voice that says, wait a minute, we should be careful. We should be cautious. Look at what's happening in other places. I'm not trying to suppress, the fact that in some places where there isn't a lot of incidents or there's, they're more isolated communities, I totally understand why people want to have more flexibility. But at the same time, I also get that, a simple thing like wearing a mask doesn't really compromise very much on anybody. I wear mine all the time when I'm out. It's one of those little things that we can do in the interest of the greater good. So that said, your voices are important. Your voices need to be heard. We're encouraging people to stay flexible. I saw one of the comments about, sick leave and working from home and those kinds of things. And I am expecting that the education community will show the same level of flexibility that it did during the school building closure to accommodate the particular circumstances that exist. Because hopefully those accommodations are not, long-winded, or that they're going to, for 10 years. It's really just to kind of get through this particular part of the process that we're in. And we're going to have to acknowledge that that's the right thing to do right now. So, keep up the great work you're doing. Be on the lookout. Be diligent in your own practices, right? Practice low-risk behavior to the extent that you see yourself as a participant in what is going to be a process of bringing lots of people together and sending them back home every day or some days a week. Just that kind of activity adds to the risk for our communities and our state. And to the extent that you have choices about the behaviors you engage in, both when you're in your professional roles and when you're in your personal roles, think about that as you move forward.
All right. Well, thank you again. And I know there's questions in the chat box about how people will be able to access this information. I need to work on that with staff, but we will make sure that everybody does have access to the recording. And as we get answers to those questions, that we share those. That's why it's just really important that you've registered so that we know how to find you to get that information out. Yes, Nick Urich said that he will email everyone in the session with directions on how to access the recording. So we do have a good I think we've got a good record of the 95 or 99 people that are with us here. So thank you again, Dr. Francis, Mr. DeMaria. I will address one other question, and that is, when are people going to see the actual guidance? We are waiting for the governor's announcement. And Paulo, again, my understanding is that once the governor makes his announcement, then the guidance document that has been developed will be official and sent out. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. Enjoy the rest of your day and your conference, and look forward to seeing you soon.